just to ask you when you came into social work.
Well, if by social work you mean public assistance, it was never regarded as social work at that time.
Yes.
That will be in 1938.
38, yes.
Mm. Just before the war, so that I had a short spell before going into the forces, a couple of years or so.
Were you an RO?
Not at that time. I was recruited as a clerical assistant. I think there are about 160 candidates for two vacancies. It shows how popular local government was then compared with the present day, doesn't it?
Yes, it certainly when does.
Youngsters won't come into local government today.
No.
They all go into computing.
Yes, that's right.
But that was the situation then, and I was allocated to a small local office in Nelson, Cotton Town, as you probably know. Had its problems through the years of depression, which I just remember as a youngster and a teenager. And first morning at work, I was there promptly, as people were in those days. They don't bother today, do they?
No.
And I heard, coming up the hill to the office, two people talking very loudly. And they arrived and I was still on the doorstep. And they said, "Oh, you're early, you don't want to come to work so early." One of them was the RO, short, tubby man.
Yes.
And the other was the assistant RO,
yes.
Long like a lath.
Yes.
Long fellow,
yes.
And they were both ex-miners.
Yes.
And that first morning in the office, I'll never forget it, they were rough diamonds, but they knew the stuff. And the RO, first of all, I said, "Now, Jack, did you spend the first morning in this office with me?" And he said, "I'll show you the outdoor relief list.
Yes.
Show you how it's kept."
Yes.
And he said, "Atherton, who was the assistant, he'll be going in the back room to receive the clients who'll be coming in, new applicants, or to report changes or otherwise." So I spent the first couple of hours going through this list, and his comments were, "Now take notice of me, don't bother about him in the back room. If you listen to what I say and get a grasp of this, so you won't go far wrong."
Yes.
"And don't bother, he can't manage the books."
Yes.
And then after a couple of hours, he said, "Well, go in the other room now and see what he's doing." And in a lull between clients, as we call them now, applicants we used to call them, Atherton said, "Now, if you want to know how to deal with people," he said, "don't bother with him. He says, I'll just take notice of Adam." And he said, "I'll take you on compulsory removals, lunacy, and mental treatment act action." He said, "Billy," this is Roland, the RO, he said, he leaves that side all to me."
Yes.
He said, "So you follow." So I followed them both, really. I was taught by both. And my word, what a grounding that was.
Yes. And so you did that job right up to going into the army, did you?
Yes, I went in the Air Force in 1940.
Yes.
And I'd already started studying for my relieving officer's certificate. And I got that before I went in the forces.
You did get your relieving
officer? I got my relieving officer's certificate at, I would be 20, I suspect.
Yes.
Or just under 20. Couldn't be more, because I went in the forces at 20.
Can you know what you had to do for that certificate?
Yes, the law of settlement and removal, law of lunacy and mental treatment, general duties of an RO, which I recollect was the most difficult paper, because you had to know the entire poor law code and be able to quote, I think there are 165 particular sections in the Poor Law Act, and you had to know the whole lot from A to Z. There were five subjects. I can't remember what the other two were offhand. but there were five papers in the RO's exam, and you had to pass the lot.
There was an essay too, wasn't there?
There was an essay, that's right, yes.
But can you remember what your essay was?
Can't. No, I can't remember. But I did get through that exam, and by the time I took that and passed, the old relieving officer I mentioned had retired, and a new one took his place. It was a transfer from the Fleetwood area.
Yes.
And he remained in public assistance and then in social services until his retirement a couple of years ago. But I was too young at that stage to be appointed RO, because you couldn't be appointed under 21, even if I'd had the experience.
Yes.
But it was there. I got what was called the RO's ticket.
Yes.
And then in the RAF, I'd spells in Canada and the Middle East, and as the war was drawing to an end, I thought I'll take my clerical assistance exams, which were quite, I mean, the name doesn't convey the standard.
Yes.
But I actually took those whilst I was in the forces before demobilisation and got both parts one and part two and came back, in effect, with an RO's ticket and the clerical assistance.
Is that the DMA?
No, that was much later.
So
I came back, I was demobilised in 1946, and Lancashire County Council, who I started with, during the war, all the appointments of ROs were temporary, because they felt it was right to give the people who had gone in the forces the opportunity, when they return, to be in competition for any vacancies that had arisen. So that when I came back, a number of posts came up, and within a very short time I was appointed RO in Cone, in Lancashire, in the northeast corner of Lancashire, an old Roman town.
Yes.
But of course public assistance had changed a good deal between the pre-war period and 46, because pensioners in particular were being taken off public assistance by legislation in 40, widows and so on, so that it was a diminishing number of clients or applicants.
Yes. Can you remember any anecdotes or examples of the sort of work you did at that time in those early post-war years?
Well, when I was RO, I mean, or when I was in the earlier days before the war, I think the number of people on the books in the office I mentioned would be about 400. When I went to Cone and was appointed RO then, I would imagine at about 150 on the books. We used to do the entire service, if that's the right name for it, visiting. You knew all the clients, you knew them, you knew the families, you visited them, you paid them money on the paying out day they came to the office. Some were paid by post, those who couldn't come. And it had begun in those pre-war years and the post-war years, I think, and I'm not just saying this because I was involved in it, but it had become a very humane service. And the people who were working in it, the old ROs I mentioned earlier, were very, very kind, caring people, wanting to do their best within the system. And really ensuring that people got what they were entitled to, whereas if you took it further back, it was the other approach, give them as little as possible. But the whole climate, philosophy almost had changed.
How do you account for that?
I think it was some of the influences flowed from the Depression years. And I think that very often the people who were actually in the case of unemployment benefit, or UAB as it was then, and public assistance, the people who were providing a service were the people who'd been through very hard times.
Yes.
And I think they had an understanding about what people were going through. And I think that's one very crucial influence. The people who were actually working the system had direct experience of the hardship. But that's just my personal view about it. And certainly you see, the RO in those days, I mean, my 2 years as an RO, if you made a judgment on the basis of medical evidence or anything else that someone required hospital treatment, you had the authority to demand a bed, a vacancy.
Yes.
The RO's power to act in sudden or urgent necessity was endless, open-ended.
Yes.
Section 17, Poor Law Act 1930. Writ large.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, you were only answerable to the district auditor, isn't that right?
That's right. Yes. Enormous flexibility.
Was that easily understood by your colleagues? I mean, your senior colleagues, did they understand that when you took decisions?
Oh, I think so. Yes, I think so. I mean, there were all kinds of occurrences with hospitals, with medical staff. You see, in those days, you had the voluntary hospitals and the general hospitals, which were managed by local government.
Yes.
And the voluntary hospitals, I always used to think it was funny. If I admitted someone to a general hospital on an RO's order, as it was called, because I couldn't get they couldn't get in at the voluntary hospital, there was an agreement that the voluntary hospital would pay, I think it was 21 shillings a week for 3 weeks, because that individual was a voluntary contributor.
Yes.
And of course it was a very modest contribution. And we used to play hell about this misleading situation where people who were contributing voluntarily, the tuppence or fourpence or sixpence a week to voluntary hospitals, when they came to need voluntary hospital care, no vacancy for them, no prospect of early admission, go to the RO to get the bureaucratic order to get them into the general hospital.
Yes.
Funny, really. I mean, that won't be written down in history, will it?
No.
Really?
No, you're right. Yes.
Yeah. So, and I think the same sort of issues arose with mental hospital admissions, where you see ROs were very familiar not only with the legislation but with some of the what were the newer forms of treatment and the extent to which psychiatrists were using the temporary provisions and the voluntary provisions of the Mental Treatment Act of 1930. Very important distinctions. And some reluctance to use those 1930 Act provisions, particularly for temporary treatment, where the patient had no volition, but you could actually use the temporary arrangements under the 30 Act without going through the relieving officer for either a Section 23 day order or a Section 21 14 day order.
You
know, that sort of thing. Yes. Fascinating, really.
Yes.
Mm.
Well, that's Section 20 of the 30 Act or the 90 Act?
Yeah, the 90 Act, the Section 20.
Yes,
that's right.
The old three-day order.
That's right. Which, in a way, is continued in present legislation with the 72-hour.
So you actually were building up experience both in the health, what later became the health and welfare.
Yes, very much so. I mean, personally, you see, with that, the grounding I'd had, even in those couple of years before the war, and then about 2 years as RO, you saw every side of that work, very much so. The institutional side, the mental hospital side, and so on.
I know it's a long time ago now, but I wondered whether you can bring to mind any case examples that particularly hit you at the time.
Well, I think the things that strike you are there are three, perhaps, individual cases that I remember. I don't remember names, obviously, but I remember going... The first memory I have of an individual, and this is a bit macabre in a way, but it was someone didn't turn up for payment. And this was before the war when I was clerical assistant. Didn't turn up at the office for the money.
When you were 20?
Yeah, 19 or 20. Quite young. And the RO said, better pop up, see what's happened. Might not be so well. Take the money.
Yeah.
Pay him And when I went, I went in and found the fellow dead in the chair.
Mm.
Now that's now at the time, I don't think anyone would think, anyone in the office would think about the effect that would have on a youngster 19 or 20.
Right. Mm.
And I had to cope with it to get the doctor and the police, and I did.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that was really throwing me in at the deep end.
It certainly was.
Unwittingly, but I had to cope with it.
Yeah.
That isn't humorous, but it nevertheless, it's something quite interesting.
Yeah.
And then there was another occasion, which is different altogether, but it has a bit of death about it, where we were having some problems with the contractor who carried out the burials, public assistance burials. And even in that day, it was quite a reasonable specification. It wasn't just a box.
Yes.
It included linings and so on. Mm. We got a suspicion that something was happening, that the contract wasn't being complied with. So it was suggested that I ought to go to where they were making these things, have a look round, and see if the linings were going in.
Yes.
And my visit wasn't conclusive on that. So that when a funeral was taking place, sometime afterwards, we insisted on opening the coffin, and there was no lining in. That was one of these extraordinary jobs that, you know, and it was really to pin down the the contractor on what he was providing. And it was a case where there were no relatives at the funeral, but we went and insisted on seeing the corpse, you know. As and so that's a couple. The other one is rather a nice story, where I think on the... I think it was the last day of the public assistance regime, and one of the applicants came and presented me with a book in appreciation of the help over a comparatively short period that I'd given to this particular widow.
Yes.
And that was the Ruby Atabomai Kayan.
Okay.
And I thought, that's always stuck in my memory. Yes. There are lots of other funny stories, such as when I went to a household that was riddled with tuberculosis, and the father, I think there were five or six children in the family, he died, and all the family were behaving as though he was, you know, he just didn't, he wasn't there as a dead person. They're just carrying on as, and excluding that sort of, almost excluding that event.
Yes.
Which, and tuberculosis went through pretty well all the kids of that family.
Mm.
Quite, you know, those, I mean, you don't hear much of tuberculosis these days.
This is before...
That was just after the war.
And of course, it has
just after the war.
So then 1948 came, and...
48 was my first experience of reorganisation, where the Public Assistance Service, in the words of an Irin Bevin, was buried. And the Lancashire County Council, good authority, Lancashire, there was no question of jobs not being available for the people in the service if they could be fitted in. But the option at that time was whether or not, I mean, all the people in public assistance, I think, applied for jobs with the Ministry of National Insurance, which, or the National Assistance Board. Or Assistance Board. It changed its name to Assistance Board in 1940, I think. So now, I was notified that I will be appointed as an executive officer to the Ministry of National Insurance in Blackpool, head office, Norcross. And I think it was only about a couple of weeks before I was due to take up that post that the person who'd been appointed as the senior administrative officer for a health and welfare division in Lancashire, the combined health and welfare in the new setup in Lancashire. Yes. Some authorities had separate welfare departments, Lancashire didn't, and they had a divisional administration set up. And the person who was appointed was previously the public assistance officer for the area.
Oh, yeah.
And he decided to take his option with the Ministry of National Insurance.
Yeah.
And the new committee, which was set up, a divisional committee, appointed me at a very late stage, two or three weeks before the new arrangements came into operation.
So can I just look quite clear? Did you have a choice, or were you drafted?
In effect, I had a choice at the end. It was a choice in the sense that before the 5th of July, I was reconsidered because someone moved out as a senior administrative officer and was appointed. Now, other people did have to go to the National Assistance Board or the Ministry of National Insurance because they'd no other option.
Yes.
It was coincidental, if you like, good luck, if you like, that that option came my way, which at that time avoided a move. I was a single person, but it avoided a move from home because as RO in Cone, living in Nelson, I was just travelling, and similarly as senior administrative officer, the offices were on the outskirts of Burnley, so that it didn't mean a move, whereas going to MNI in Blackpool did, so that the salary was better too as senior administrative officer, so when that was offered, I took it.
Yes.
And that was a health division number 6, Lancashire County Council, which had a population of about 96,000 of them at that time.
Yes.
And that was the beginning of the, I suppose, the development of health and welfare services on the new basis following the legislation of 48.
Yes, that must have been quite a proposition sorting out.
Yes, it was bringing a new group of people were brought together in administrative terms. People working in clinics and so on generally stayed in those health service settings. The public assistance institution, whilst it in theory finished, I mean it was separated between sick and non-sick. The people stayed there until new small homes for the elderly were opened. And actually, a small home for elderly people, 12 people, was on the stocks in 1947 in Cone, Lancashire County Council home, so that I can't remember exactly when it was opened, but I think it was probably open either just before or just after the appointed day. So very early on, I had that experience of a small adapted home for elderly people, which, in the words of an R in Bevan, was to be provided as an alternative to the workhouse. And in fact, people who were going in there, you thought of them as people going into a home which was very similar to a small hotel.
Yes.
Not really needing care and attention as we know it today, but a small establishment of that kind. And then, of course, as time went on, because there was no capital building in those years, I mean, I think the capital building restrictions lasted till the mid-50s.
Yes.
But some authorities, and Lancashire were one, they acquired almost the stately homes of England here and there to provide alternatives to the public assistance provision and gradually began to run down public assistance institutions. I think in every authority I've been, I've closed down a public assistance institution because it's taken, well, I think there may be one or two still going, but it's taken since 48 to the present day and there are probably one or two public assistance institutions
still around.
I mean, the last one we closed in Dorset was two or three years ago, Starview. I helped to close one in Bromley and in South Shields. They just closed it.
Yes.
So that it takes a long, long time for new policies to be fully implemented, doesn't it?
Yes, it certainly does. Yes. The senior administrative officer is like, what, a divisional director?
Well, the setup was this. If I just explain the setup, generally, there was a divisional medical officer who was responsible for health and welfare services in the area, and were responsible to the county medical officer of Lancashire, really, in line accountability, and had a divisional committee to whom he reported and who made decisions within the delegation scheme adopted by the county council for health and welfare services.
These were local government officers.
The committee were elected members from the constituent authorities.
Oh, I see.
So you'd have a couple of representatives from the Borough of Nelson, Colne, and one or two co-opted members, and so on. With the sort of divisional administration at that time was concerned with all the local authority services under the National Health Service Act of 46, which included day nurseries, a couple of day nurseries then, which had been set up in the war, two or three day nurseries in the area. So I have a long experience of day nurseries, clinics of various kinds, convalescent home care, health visiting services, district nursing, district midwifery, all those services, the domiciliary services, if you like, which had a health service connotation, were within the orbit of that particular organisation, together with the services under the National Assistance Act 48. So that broadly was the focus, the National Assistance Act services and the mental health services. I mean, the interesting thing on the 5th of July was that my wife, who was the mental welfare officer for the county in another area, came into that division as a mental welfare officer. That's when I met her, on the 5th of July, 48, and we got married about 12 months later. But, I mean, that people were brought together from different settings, and that was broadly the remit of the authority, so that I mean, some of the things which were developed in those earlier days were the home health service. I had a lot to do with the organisation of the ambulance service in the area, the beginnings of new services for the physically handicapped, in getting, we weren't recruiting occupational therapists in those days, but we were recruiting handicraft instructors and setting up social centres for the handicapped. One of which in Nelson, I think it was at my initiative, we set up, is still going strong in what is now a multi-purpose centre. And a couple of years ago, I had a contact with the secretary who was one of the founder members in those early 50 years. A very physically handicapped person with a wheelchair and so on. So that was the setting for the next, as far as my career was concerned, for the next 9 years till I moved to South Shields.
To what extent, you mentioned services and buildings, but to what extent was taken on board that there'd be a need for people like social workers, I mean, called something different perhaps, social welfare officers, to present the services to the public?
Well, I think, I suppose you see, there were duly authorised officers in those days, particularly on the mental health side, to carry out statutory functions, and they were doing quite a bit of, it varied from authority to authority, but the extent to which they were doing pre-care, again, depended on the liaison arrangements with doctors, and very often the people who've been in public assistance carried through their work, or have been in mental deficiency or mental health, carried through their work, and they already had a relationship with doctors, so that quite a bit of pre-care and aftercare was carried on. As far as services for the elderly were concerned, at that stage, I mean, one wasn't thinking about people who are now described as social workers, but you were thinking about caring people who could handle personal problems and who were trying to help people in difficulty. So that I'm pretty sure that at that stage, the possible impact of social work on, say, in working with the elderly mm-hmm. wasn't really appreciated.
No.
Was with children because of yes. the Curtis recommendations, yes. the Children Act, and the extent to which, along with the Curtis recommendations, training was embodied in the total strategy.
Yes.
I mean, training in childcare was embodied, I think, before the actual legislation
yes.
in the 47 setting up of the Central yes. Training Council in yes. childcare yes. or whatever it was called at that time.
Yes.
So that's the right way to do it.
Yes.
If you prepare a strategy, you ought yes. to get your training input clarified
yes.
at first, so that it wasn't until many years later, till the setting up of the Young Husband mm-hmm. Committee,
mm-hmm.
that one really began to focus on the importance of social work
yes.
with other client groups.
Yes.
It was well recognised with those yes. suffering from mental illness,
yes.
and you had a small but skilled group of psychiatric social workers mm. and mental welfare officers who had undergone some kind of training,
mm-hmm.
Which was equipping them in a specialist field. Yes. So there was a recognition of the importance mm. of that group. But it wasn't until the report of Young Husband Committee, yes. which gave an impetus,
yes.
and it did give a real impetus to training in the sort of social welfare yes. side.
Because yes. there was nothing for them.
Not really, no. not really.
Mm.
Mm. So that, I mean, it was interesting that after the Council for Training in Social Work was set up to provide training for those in the health and welfare field, including mm. the mental welfare officers, that I think the actual number of people completing courses came up in a fairly short period comparatively to the same level of people who were going through the childcare training, and then of course there was the fusion of the two mm. at a much later date.
Yes. Did you give evidence on behalf of your authority?
Not on behalf of the authority, but at that time I was very much involved with the Institute of Social Welfare.
Oh, yes.
And for some years I was secretary of that institute.
Can you tell me a bit about that then as well, the Institute of Social Welfare?
The Institute, yes, that was set up soon after 1948. Again, I'm speaking from recollection
so that
the dates are not likely to be accurate. But there are one or two founder members of the Institute still around, I think. Len Moulton, who was the director mm-hmm. of welfare services in Bournemouth, was, I think, one of the founder members of the mm-hmm. Institute of Social Welfare. And its main objective was to bring people in the new services mm-hmm. together and to provide some form of training for them.
Yes.
Now, it never did achieve mm. that objective of mounting training programs, mm. although it did bring a great number of people together to discuss mm-hmm. professional issues related to the services, and certainly did produce a statement of mm. evidence to various committees that were set
yes.
up to look at different aspects of services. And I'm pretty certain, although I can't remember the content, that evidence was produced to Young Husband,
mm.
and I know that oral evidence was given as well. I think at that time, probably people like George Evans of Cheshire and Tom Tinto,
mm-hmm.
Who was on... Now, was he on Young
yes.
Husband? He was on Young Husband.
Him, yeah.
I mean, they were very influential
yes.
people
yes.
at that time in that forum
yes.
and were very enthusiastic
yes.
about creating opportunities
hmm.
for training. Hmm.
Did you feel yourselves then at a disadvantage as compared with people in the child care service? When you talked about...
I'm not so sure that... I mean, we felt that there was a need for training. I think
mm.
the work was seen as different.
Mm.
And I wouldn't have thought that people working in the health or welfare fields really thought themselves at a disadvantage. They may have done. I don't know. Certainly there was a general feeling that there was more to learn,
mm.
and there was an an application of theory and practice, which was desirable in dealing with the elderly, the physically handicapped. Because remember, in those 48 years after 1948, I mean, it's quite interesting how services did develop for those client groups. I mean, not only in the residential sphere with the new homes for the elderly, but in community initiatives, because I mean, years and years ago in the 50s, we were being we were exhorting voluntary agencies to cooperate, particularly with services for the physically handicapped. I mean, I can remember one of the early circulars in 1951, which is saying something about the role of voluntary bodies, which has a very familiar ring to it in relation to what the government are saying now.
Right.
So it's, you know, we're on the...
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Bit of déjà vu.
Yeah. I mean, the reason why I asked you whether you felt at a disadvantage in relation to the childcare service is because my memory of those days, and I was sort of just beginning in social work at that time, was that there was a sort of feeling of there being some kind of hierarchy. At the top of this hierarchy, although they weren't part of the local authority, but you know, where I worked in Nottinghamshire, they were nearby, there was the probation service.
Yeah,
they all had individual rooms and plenty of technology for and secretarial help, you know, doing the records.
Yeah.
Then there was the childcare service, who had a much bigger establishment of field workers than we did in the mental health service, because mental health and welfare were separate in Nottinghamshire.
Yeah.
And then
that was where Pynchon was, wasn't it?
That's right, yes.
Another influential person, you see.
Yes.
We talk about unit homes for the elderly today. The one that was burnt down at Edwalton was a unit home, built in 1956.
Yes.
Sorry, I interrupted.
No, that's all right. by unit home, what do you mean?
It facilitated small groups of residents living together, eating together, and then a central concourse sort of thing, which is all the rage at the moment. I mean, we're providing our new establishment, unit home, but that one, and it wasn't the only one, but Nottinghamshire and I think Derbyshire, due to the influence of Pynchon and Chambers, really...
Yes.
Pioneered
this
kind of home to provide a more homely atmosphere in an institutional setting and so on. And they also pioneered some of the earlier centres for the physically handicapped in those two counties.
Because we're in this clasp system of building.
Ah, well, that, I think that's not a... that was primarily because of the subsidence...
Yes.
Issues.
I mean, presumably, I wonder whether that's what brought them together. A common interest in the.
I wouldn't have thought that. I would have thought it was the quality and calibre of the two people I've mentioned. Those are not the only two, but they're two who stick in my mind, who I knew quite well, and who were always anxious to seize opportunities to do something different and better.
Yes.
Enthusiastic people.
Yes. Yes.
And many of us copied what they did.
Yes.
You know, and picked up. You tended to pick up the what you thought was the best practice and try to implement it. I mean, I remember going down to Worksop to look at a centre for the handicapped there when I was planning one in South Shields, the first that South Shields ever opened.
Yes.
They invited me back to the opening when it was completed. But I mean, that was the way you intended to do it.
Yes.
People would come to South Shields to look at one particular home that the concept was my concept, which was linked to a group of bungalows, so that people would come to see that. Yes. So there's a good cross-fertilisation of ideas, all really seeking to move forward.
Yes.
Anyway, we've digressed.
Yeah. Can I come back to the point I was trying to sort of provoke you with?
Yes,
about the hierarchy.
Well, my view would be different.
Yeah.
If there was a hierarchy, and it's only my perception, I would say it was the PSWs in child guidance.
Yes.
And they were the people who just stood out as the very special and very skilled people, not the probation.
Yes.
I mean, my sort of recollection of probation isn't really a recollection. I could never remember probation officers featuring in any thoughts about the relative standards, if you like, or what is it, the value, the relative values. They wouldn't have entered into my mind. Childcare people would, but more on an equal basis to our visiting officers, because partly because we had a very good local arrangement with childcare people, nearly finished. And interestingly enough, in my little corner of Lancashire, I finish up as director. George Crichton, who was the area children's officer in Nelson, is director for Stockport. And Helen Seed, who worked with him, is the director for West Sussex. All out of that little small corner of North East Lancashire. Yes. And Geoffrey Ellis, who was in the adjoining County Borough of Burnley, now director of, is it Walsall? I think it's still called Walsall, isn't it?
Yes.
Interesting, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And, yes, Lancashire's contributed quite a number of...
Barry
Newell and Tom White also.
That's
Lancashire
right.
Land,
yeah, well, I think Tom White's a Welshman, really.
Yeah,
but
I mean, he built his career up in the Lancashire childcare
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I suppose, can I press my point a bit further then?
Yeah.
I mean, it's really to do with, well, let's exclude the probation service, because I suppose the one thing the probation service, problem the probation service didn't have on round its neck was having to provide facilities like homes for the elderly and day centres and so on and so on. But, I mean, I remember in the my Nottinghamshire days that we had one MWO who was on duty every night of the week and every weekend. At one point, because his adjoining MW, there was no one in the in establishment, and he was left for quite a long period before they made an appointment. And they wouldn't even give him two people's mileage allowances, so he was soon on the taking a mile or whatever it was after
the
session. And I mean, he really was, he was on duty, as I say, back the whole time.
Always on call.
And sort of the psychiatrist we both worked with used to call him the unofficial psychotherapist for Mansfield, because they were used to call up at his office to see him.
Yes. Well, I think you've got a fair point there. I mean, I would
really... Never ever reached the staffing norms that were recommended.
No, certainly not. In I mean, you'd had the McIntosh report, you'd had various reports about mental health services, and the staffing norms and the training related to those staffing norms. I mean, now we're talking about PSW training were never achieved. And it's quite true to say, I mean, even in my days as RO, I was on call all the time.
Yeah.
If I went out, I had to say where I was, and it wasn't unusual for me to be called out of a cinema or a dance hall to attend to people. And the mental welfare officer in the post 48 years, because I acted in emergency between 48 and 57, and there were only two of us for a while for so the entire area, and then we got a further person. That's right. That's right. So you're quite right that, I mean, when you compare that with standby arrangements today, it's a luxury job today.
Yes, absolutely.
And paid for it too.
Yes.
No pay for standby then.
No. Well, and you were saying that the Institute of Social Welfare was sort of kind of concerned about training and trying to allow its own incidents.
Yes, I think the Institute...
How did you set about that?
Well, I think the Institute and members of it were very influential in focusing attention on the need for training in the services.
Yes.
They hadn't the facility to organise courses. I mean, they would have... Had they had the backing of an organisation, I think the objective was to provide courses for people in these, inverted commas, new services.
Yes.
And, I mean, it was beyond that kind of association. So that they tried to exercise their influence, not only through the Ministry of Health, as it was then, and Geraldine Aves, who's probably another person on your list, who was Chief Welfare Officer, and she had a great deal of influence there. But I think that the very fact that members of the Institute were involved in the Young Husband Inquiry in itself indicates the stance of the Institute and the regard it was held in at that time as the only organisation crossing these boundaries too between residential and what we now call field service. So that I think it was, because at the time it was the only organisation, it had a good deal of influence. Its influence has waned in recent years because of the emergence of new training, new professional groups and so on. And I wouldn't pretend that it is now the influential body it was in those fairly, well, not I was going to say early years, but over a long period, really.
You know, well, I tell you what was just going through my mind when you were saying that, and perhaps you, being in an authority where health and welfare were combined, you've experienced this. But for the Mental Welfare Office has always had the NAMH to turn to, didn't they?
Yes,
because the NAMH used to lay on short courses.
That's right.
I guess there was no equivalent body, the Institutes, I mean, the Society of Mental Welfare Officers could turn to the NMH for help in laying on courses.
Well, there were some courses. The National People's Welfare Council provided some courses. National People's Welfare Council provided some short courses. Yes. I used to go in as tutor to some of them, mainly for the staff of residential homes.
Yes.
National Association for Mental Health provided a few short courses for similar groups, didn't they, on the mental health side, not only for residential but for field staff, because the residential provision in mental health, in a way, came after the... It came at a later...